October 18th, 1949, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Dorothy Forstein, the 40-year-old wife of a local magistrate, is discovered to be missing from her home. Even though there are no signs of forced entry, Dorothy's 9-year-old stepdaughter claims that an unidentified man entered Dorothy's bedroom and carried her unconscious body out of the residence. There is speculation that Dorothy's disappearance might be connected to another incident from nearly 5 years earlier, where she was violently attacked by an unknown individual inside the house, but no trace of Dorothy is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a terrifying missing persons case which took place over 70 years ago, the 1949 disappearance of Dorothy Forstein. I've received a few requests to cover this one because it's a horrifying story which pretty much faded from the spotlight for several decades, but seems to have become the subject of discussion from online sleuths in recent years. Dorothy Forstein was a housewife and mother from Philadelphia who was married to a local magistrate named Jules Forstein, but after returning home late one night, Jules discovered that two of his children were alone and seemed terrified. Sure enough, Jules' 9-year-old daughter Marcy would soon share a shocking story about having witnessed an unidentified man abduct Dorothy from the residence, and while the authorities were initially skeptical about this, a psychiatrist who interviewed Marcy believed she was likely telling the truth. Believe it or not, this was not the first unsolved crime to take place in that house, as nearly 5 years earlier, Dorothy was attacked by an assailant who inflicted some serious injuries on her, but no one was able to figure out the identity of the perpetrator. Could the same person have returned to finish the job and abducted Dorothy? And if so, what was their motive? While this case got a lot of exposure in the newspapers at the time it originally happened, it seems like the media coverage became non-existent after Dorothy was legally declared dead years later. And even though Dorothy has never been found, there was a time period when it appeared like her family was going out of their way to scrub all mention of this story from the internet. I'll go into more details about that later on in this episode, but this is definitely a very bizarre and perplexing case which needs to be explored on this podcast. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the disappearance of Dorothy Forstein. Our story begins in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania in 1949. Our central figure is 40-year-old Dorothy Cooper Forstein, who is currently married to her 43-year-old husband, Jules Forstein. Dorothy and Jules had actually been childhood sweethearts before they went their separate ways, and Jules wound up getting married to a woman named Molly Melliton Forstein in 1928. Over the next 12 years, the couple had a pair of daughters named Myrna and Marcy, but tragically, on July 2, 1940, Molly died at the age of 36 due to complications from giving birth to Marcy. About a year later, Jules became reacquainted with Dorothy, and they would start a relationship and get married in 1942. At this point, Jules was working as a clerk for the Philadelphia City Council, but when the magistrate of court number 18 passed away the following year, the governor of Pennsylvania appointed Jules to take his place, and he would be officially elected to the position months later. In 1944, Jules and Dorothy finally had a child of their own, when she gave birth to a son named Edward. The Forrestein family would eventually move into a three-story suburban home located on North Franklin Street, and by all accounts, Jules and Dorothy's marriage was described as being a happy one. By 1949, Jules was up for re-election for his second term as magistrate of Court No. 18, so after finishing work on the evening of October the 18th, he was planning to attend a political banquet. At 7 p.m., Jules phoned Dorothy at the residence to let her know that he probably wouldn't be home until late. When they ended the call, Dorothy said the words, quote, "Be sure to miss me," but this would turn out to be the last time Jules ever heard from his wife. By this point, Jules' oldest daughter Myrna was 19 years old and spending the night with a friend, so Dorothy would be watching over Marcy, who was now 9, and Edward, who was 5. At 9 p.m., Dorothy phoned one of her friends to arrange a shopping trip for the following day, but even though the friend believed that everything sounded normal with Dorothy during the call, this was the last time she was confirmed to be alive. When Jules finally returned home at 11:30, he noticed that the front door was locked, so he opened it and went inside before he headed upstairs. Jules was surprised to discover that Dorothy was not there, and Marcy and Edward were now clinging together inside Marcy's bedroom, crying and looking frightened. When Jules asked what was going on, the kids replied, quote, "Mommy's gone." Marcy then proceeded to share a shocking story with her father. She claimed that she had been sleeping before she was awakened by a loud noise. When Marcy went out into the hallway, she saw a man suddenly appear by climbing up the stairs. She said she did not recognize the man, but described him as being a white male who looked between 40 to 45 years old and was wearing a brown peaked cap and also appeared to have, quote-unquote, something brown in his shirt. Marcy then looked into her stepmother's bedroom and noticed that Dorothy was lying face down on the floor while clad only in her red silk pajamas and red slippers. The man then proceeded to enter Dorothy's bedroom before he picked up her limp body and draped it over his shoulder. When the man walked back into the hallway and Marcy asked him what he was doing, he responded by patting her head and saying, quote, "Go back to sleep, little one. Your mom is fine." He then carried Dorothy downstairs and exited the house, presumably locking the front door behind him. Since Marcy could not go back to sleep, she woke up Edward, and they hid together in her bedroom until their father returned home about 15 minutes later. Well, Jules was initially skeptical of Marcy's story, so he spent the next few hours searching for Dorothy and calling up a number of her relatives, friends, and neighbors. Since they all said they hadn't seen Marcy, Jules finally contacted the Philadelphia Police Department at around 3:40 a.m. on the morning of October the 19th in order to report her missing. When police arrived at the Forrestein residence, they noticed that Dorothy's purse and keys were still there, and there were no signs of any struggle or forced entry. The only fingerprints which could be found at the house belonged to members of the family, and none of the neighbors reported seeing or hearing anything unusual. It wasn't long before Marcy shared the same story with police about having witnessed her stepmother's abduction, and like Jules, they were initially skeptical. So they arranged for Marcy to be interviewed by a psychiatrist, who concluded that the girl was likely telling the truth. The original newspaper coverage of Dorothy's disappearance mentioned the possibility of her going missing because she had amnesia. But on October the 23rd, 5 days after Dorothy was last seen, the papers finally published Marcy's story about the abduction, and investigators publicly expressed their belief that Dorothy may have become the victim of foul play. Well, believe it or not, years earlier, Dorothy had been the victim of another terrifying attack at the Forrestein residence. On January the 25th, 1945, Dorothy dropped her children off at a neighbor's house in order to do some shopping, but right after she returned home at around 8:30 p.m., she was attacked by an unidentified individual. While this was going on, the house phone's receiver was knocked off the hook, which automatically connected to a switchboard operator. Dorothy didn't get the chance to say anything, but since the operator could hear the sound of commotion on the line, she dispatched the police to the Forrestein residence. By the time they arrived, Dorothy's attacker was gone, and she was lying unconscious on the floor. She had been beaten so viciously that she suffered a concussion, and her injuries included a broken nose, a broken jaw, and a fractured shoulder. After Dorothy was rushed to the hospital for treatment, she eventually regained consciousness, but said that all she could remember is someone jumping out and hitting her. She didn't get a good look at her attacker and was unable to provide a description. One of Dorothy's neighbors did report seeing a man walking behind her as she arrived home from her shopping trip. The neighbor said it was too dark to get a good look at this man, but since there were no signs of forced entry at the residence, it was possible that he could have followed Dorothy inside after she opened the front door and attacked her. The only fingerprints that could be found in the house belonged to members of the family, and since nothing was stolen, and Dorothy's purse was still resting by her side, robbery did not appear to be the motive. Police believe that the crime was an attempted murder, and the perpetrator either failed to finish the job or prematurely fled the scene after Dorothy knocked the phone off the hook and connected with the switchboard operator. Jules had a solid alibi placing him elsewhere when the assault took place, and since Dorothy was a very well-liked person who did not have any known enemies, no one could figure out why she was targeted. Even though Dorothy had been known as a happy and carefree individual, the attack seemed to change her personality. She became a lot more paranoid and cautious, as she always ensured that the doors and windows of her residence were locked, and rarely ever ventured outside after dark. Needless to say, since the attacker could not be found, this led to speculation that the same person might have returned nearly 5 years later and abducted her. Due to Jules' job as a magistrate, it was theorized that a defendant who once appeared in his courtroom might have developed a personal grudge against Jules and gone after his wife as revenge. However, Jules maintained that he could not think of anyone who hated him enough to do that. On October the 21st, 3 days after Dorothy went missing, a patrolman named Edward Shapiro believed that he saw her in Camden, New Jersey, located just across the Delaware River from Philadelphia. Shapiro noticed a blonde woman exiting a candy store telephone booth near the corner of Federal and 4th Street and was struck by her resemblance to Dorothy. He said that when the woman saw him, she seemed startled, and even though Shapiro followed her to a tavern and witnessed her order a beer, she took off after she noticed him again. Well, the following evening, Shapiro said that he saw this blonde woman again on the same corner, only this time she was speaking to a male companion. Before she took off, Shapiro overheard her say the words, quote, "I've only got one arm." This comment piqued everyone's interest because Dorothy had suffered a badly dislocated shoulder when she was attacked in 1945, and the injury was so recurrent that she was forced to visit the hospital at least 3 times per year to have her shoulder reset. For this reason, there was hope that Dorothy might turn up at a hospital somewhere to have her shoulder reset again, but she never did. The search for Dorothy was very extensive, as police checked hospitals, hotels, morgues, and convalescent homes all over the country. They sent out around 10,000 missing persons notices containing Dorothy's description, and Jules offered a $1,000 reward for information. The police also got a court order to open up a safety deposit box that Dorothy had under her name at a local bank. It turned out that the box contained $9,946 in securities which were left behind, making it less likely that Dorothy disappeared of her own accord. Only weeks after his wife went missing, Jules wound up winning his re-election for magistrate of court number 18, but the following year, he suffered a heart attack, which required him to receive constant treatment over the course of the next decade. On January the 1st, 1956, Jules' heart finally gave out on him, and he was found dead inside his home at the age of 49. Just 24 hours earlier, Jules had taken the oath and been sworn in for his third term as magistrate of court number 18 after being re-elected to the position again. He had gone out to celebrate New Year's Eve with another married couple and returned home at around 4 a.m., where he passed away a short time later. Myrna had since gotten married and moved out, so Marcy and Edward were celebrating New Year's at a residence when their father passed away. In September of 1957, Myrna filed a petition to have Dorothy legally declared dead, as she had been missing for nearly 8 years. 1 month later, an orphan's court judge granted this petition. By this point, Marcy and Edward were living with Myrna, and now that Dorothy was legally deceased, they would be allowed to access all of her assets, which were kept in her safety deposit box. However, after this, the story just seemed to completely fade from the spotlight, and there has never been any further progress in the investigation. After nearly 73 years, there are still no conclusive answers about the disappearance of Dorothy Forstein. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Hi there, I would just like to take a few moments to give a shout-out to another podcast titled Wrongful Conviction. Hosted by celebrated criminal justice reform advocate and founding board member of the Innocence Project, Jason Flom, and by Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast host and producer, Maggie Freeling, Wrongful Conviction features intimate conversations with men and women who spent years in prison for crimes they did not commit. Each episode peels back the layers to tell the stories of those who have found themselves caught in a legal system gone wrong. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling airs each Monday, and Jason Flom's episodes air on Thursdays. Please search, find, and follow Wrongful Conviction wherever you listen to podcasts. So this is definitely one of the oddest missing persons cases I've ever seen, made even more confounding by the lack of exposure it has received over the past several decades. If you search online, you'll find a thread about this case in the Web Sleuths forum dating all the way back to 2005, and since there was virtually no information available about the case online at that time, some of the earliest posters in that thread wondered if Dorothy Forstein's disappearance even happened, or if it was nothing more than a spooky urban legend. However, if you delve through newspaper archives, they confirm that this story is 100% true, but all coverage of this case seemed to come to a halt after Dorothy was legally declared dead in 1957. It briefly returned to the spotlight in 1984, when authors Roger Bohr and Nigel Blundell devoted a chapter to Dorothy's abduction and the first volume of their popular book series, The World's Greatest Unsolved Crimes, though the book has since gone out of print. But curiously, Dorothy's disappearance is not even listed on all the major missing persons websites, such as the Charlie Project and the Doe Network, and I have no idea how long it's been since the authorities have made any serious attempt at an investigation. I mean, this case involved the wife of a prominent magistrate literally being abducted from her home in one of America's largest cities, with her own stepdaughter witnessing the whole thing. While it received a lot of media coverage during the first few months, and the police seemed to put everything they had into finding her, this does not fit the profile of an unsolved cold case, which would just fade into obscurity. But here's where things get even weirder. In 2003, Jason Mueller, an author who mostly specializes in horror and supernatural fiction, published an article about Dorothy Forstein's disappearance on his website, but claimed that he soon received a letter from an attorney representing the Forstein family. While the letter was not written in a threatening manner, the attorney politely asked if the post about Dorothy could be removed out of consideration for the privacy of her grieving family members. Mueller agreed to do so, but then learned that several other websites which featured his article about Dorothy's case had also received a similar letter. So it almost appeared that the Forstein family was making a concerted effort to scrub her story from the internet. Well, it's now been nearly 20 years since that letter was sent out, and there are currently a number of blogs, podcasts, and YouTube videos which have featured Dorothy's story. It's also been heavily discussed by online sleuths at Reddit and in forums like Web Sleuths, so I think it's fair game to be covered on The Trail Went Cold. But the situation only opens up a lot of unanswered questions. As far as we can tell, Dorothy was never found, so why would her surviving family members want to prevent her story from receiving additional exposure and possible answers about her fate? Well, of course, since so much time has passed, it's possible that they just wanted to move on with their lives, but the alternate explanation is that they already know, or at least have a pretty good idea of what happened to Dorothy, but this information has never been released publicly. That letter from the attorney was sent 2 decades ago, possibly at the request of Dorothy's stepchildren or children, but I can't be certain if any of them are still alive today. Her oldest stepdaughter Myrna would be in her 90s by now, while her other stepdaughter Marcy would be in her 80s, and her biological son Edward would be in his late 70s. Of course, if Marcy was still alive, it would be particularly interesting to hear her account of the night her stepmother disappeared and see if she still stuck to the same story about a male intruder carrying Dorothy out of the house. At the time this took place, the newspapers reported that there was speculation that this whole abduction scenario might have been a cover story because Dorothy was secretly placed in an institution somewhere. After all, she had already been the victim of a vicious attack in her home back in 1945, which took a severe toll on her mental health. Since this type of thing was a lot more taboo during the 1940s, perhaps Dorothy suffered some sort of breakdown and her loved ones wanted to keep it under the radar. However, both the police and Dorothy's family steadfastly denied this theory and made it clear that her disappearance was legitimate. If there was compelling evidence that Dorothy was still alive somewhere, I doubt the courts would have had her legally declared dead years later. Now, if you search online discussions about this case, you'll see a lot of suspicion directed towards Jules Forstein, not only for Dorothy's abduction, but also for the incident from nearly 5 years earlier in which she was assaulted. Of course, it sounds like Jules had a solid alibi for both these incidents, but what if he arranged for someone to enter his home and harm his wife? Since the first attempt failed in 1945, perhaps he had her abducted years later. I mean, there are definitely signs that something was off about the whole situation, as in both incidents, there was no sign of forced entry at the residence, nothing was stolen, and there didn't seem to be any discernible motive for someone to harm or abduct Dorothy. If Marcy's story is accurate, then the man who carried Dorothy out of her bedroom flat out spoke to her, but did not seem overly concerned about the presence of an eyewitness, and he simply patted Marcy on the head and told her to go back to sleep. This could be seen as a sign that Jules orchestrated the whole thing and instructed the intruder not to harm his children. It's also interesting how this incident just happened to take place when the oldest child, Myrna, was spending the night with a friend. Or should I say, oldest adult. At the time, Myrna was 19 years old, and while the abduction is believed to have occurred between 11 and 11:30 p.m. when the two youngest children were in bed, there's a good chance Myrna still would have been awake and possibly put up some resistance if an intruder broke into the house. So if the abductor was acting completely on his own, then he got very lucky that he happened to do this on a night when both Jules and Myrna were absent. And besides, Marcy only woke up because she said she heard a noise, and if this had not occurred, it's possible she would have slept through the whole thing, and no one would have had any idea what happened to Dorothy. However, it must be said that at no point during the investigation did the authorities ever publicly direct any sort of suspicion towards Jules or imply that he was a person of interest. Given that he was a magistrate, I'm sure that Jules would have been given a lot more leeway from law enforcement than the spouses of most missing women, but I'd still like to think he was thoroughly investigated. And there's also a question of motive. All of the sources I found state that everyone believed that Jules and Dorothy had a very happy marriage and never reported any issues with them. So what possible reason would Jules have to arrange the abduction and murder of his wife from their home? Well, I suppose the crime could have been financially motivated. When Jules passed away in 1956, the papers reported that he left behind an estate valued at $4,906, whereas Dorothy had left behind securities valued at $9,946 inside her safety deposit box at the bank. This meant that Jules' estate would have been worth the equivalent of around $55,000 in today's money, and Dorothy's assets would be worth $108,000. This is one reason their children began the process of declaring Dorothy legally deceased, as this would grant them access to her assets. It's not really clear how Dorothy obtained all that money, and why she was worth twice as much as her husband, as the value of Jules' estate does not seem particularly high for a man who had spent the last 12 years of his life working in a prominent position as a magistrate. However, Dorothy and Jules did not get married until 1942, and while Dorothy became a stay-at-home wife and mother, she had previously worked as the head of the cosmetics department at a large Philadelphia department store. So perhaps this allowed her to save up a decent nest egg, which she put away in her safety deposit box after she tied the knot. I've never seen any indication that Jules was suffering from financial problems at the time Dorothy went missing, but while he initially offered a $1,000 reward for information about her disappearance, he withdrew the reward months later. Jules claimed that he did this because he needed to use that money for his own expenses, though he did state that he would be willing to pay if important information came in at a later time. If Jules was struggling financially and wanted to inherit Dorothy's assets, then I suppose he could have orchestrated her abduction, but there was a big flaw in that plan. Without a body, Dorothy could not be declared legally dead until she was missing for at least 7 years, and as a magistrate, Jules would have known that. If he wanted her money, Jules could have hired someone to kill Dorothy and ensure that her body was found, as Jules didn't even get to live long enough for the 7-year waiting period to expire. Furthermore, even though Dorothy's disappearance led to a court order being used in order to open her safety deposit box, I can't be certain that Jules even knew all that money was in there. In the end, Jules did not really gain anything from his wife's disappearance, and he was only left to raise 3 children on his own as he never got remarried. Jules also suffered a heart attack less than 1 year later, which became a recurrent problem with him and ultimately led to his death at the young age of 49. So you can take this as an indication that the loss of his wife caused Jules a lot of undue stress. Given the limited information we have, I guess I can't completely rule Jules out because if his family believes he had some involvement, that might explain why an effort was made to scrub this case from the internet 2 decades ago. Overall, I do not think Jules' involvement makes a lot of sense, but the problem is that no other potential scenarios in this case make much sense either. Now, many of the blogs, podcasts, and YouTube videos you'll find about this case mention a man named Morris Anmuth, who is the only person I've ever seen pushed forward as a potential suspect in Dorothy's disappearance. Anmuth does have a slight connection to Jules Forstein, but the problem is that I see no indication that Anmuth was ever formally investigated, and you will not find his name listed in any of the official news articles about this case. I think the whole Anmuth connection originated from a thread which was started on the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit 6 years ago by a poster under the username WantToPlayBall. If you do a search on Jule Forstein's name at newspapers.com, you'll find a lot of articles which have nothing to do with his wife's disappearance because he worked as a magistrate, and his name would often get mentioned in reporting about cases which took place in his courtroom. According to Want to Play Ball, they were doing their own search on Jules' name at newspapers.com and came across some articles which piqued their interest about Morris Anmuth. However, there are a few misconceptions about the Anmuth connection, which I'll be addressing momentarily. On September the 8th, 1944, Anmuth, who was a 29-year-old Jewish textile salesman, attended a protest which was taking place at a Philadelphia railroad station where Republican presidential candidate Thomas E. Dewey was giving a speech. The story goes that a pair of Philadelphia police officers, James McCarthy and Samuel Ralston, noticed Anmuth booing in the crowd, and since they believed that his mannerisms were threatening, they proceeded to arrest Anmuth and charge him with inciting to riot, resisting arrest, disorderly conduct, and assault and battery. However, Anmuth claimed that before he was taken into custody, McCarthy and Ralston dragged him into a parking lot and proceeded to beat him for nearly 20 minutes while shouting anti-Semitic remarks. One of the officers allegedly said, quote, "It is because of your kind that we are in this war, and if this was in Germany, we wouldn't beat you, we would kill you," end quote. As a result, Anmuth decided to file countercharges against McCarthy and Ralston for assault and battery. You'll find a lot of sources which state that Jules Forstein made the decision to dismiss the charges against the two officers, leading to speculation that this caused Anmuth to hold a personal grudge against Jules and go after his wife as revenge. After all, the original assault on Dorothy took place only a few months later, in January of 1945. But the problem is that this information about Jules dismissing the charges is false, so here's what really happened. Following his arrest, Anmuth did appear in Jules' courtroom, and after Jules issued him a $10 fine on the disorderly conduct charge, Anmuth responded by filing his countercharges against McCarthy and Ralston. When a witness corroborated Anmuth's story about the beating, the case was heard in front of another magistrate named James McBride, who charged the two officers with assault and battery and ordered them to be taken into custody and each held under a $1,000 bail. In May of 1945, McCarthy, Ralston, and Anmuth all went on trial simultaneously for the respective assault and battery charges. But after deliberating for only 50 minutes, the jury elected to acquit the three defendants of all their charges. The trial took place in front of another magistrate named Claire Fennerty, who expressed her satisfaction with the verdict, and she also made a statement that the case never should have gotten past Jules Forstein's courtroom. So technically, Jules could have prevented Anmuth from going to trial if he had dropped the original assault and battery charges against him, but it was a jury who ultimately decided to allow the two officers to walk free, not Jules. Yes, Jules also fined Anmuth $10 for the disorderly conduct charge, but even though $10 was worth a lot more money in 1944, would this really have been enough to motivate Anmuth to brutally attack Dorothy? Remember, Dorothy's assault took place in January, and Anmuth, McCarthy, and Ralston did not go on trial until May. So at that point, Anmuth wouldn't have known that the two officers who attacked him would get off scot-free. And if you're trying to maintain that you've been wrongly accused of assault and battery, it's probably not a good idea to commit actual assault and battery on a magistrate's wife while you're awaiting trial on those charges. It would be one thing if Anmuth was a career criminal with a history of violence, but I haven't found anything in my research to indicate that's the case. From what I can tell, Anmuth was a law-abiding businessman who was arrested for doing nothing more than booing a political candidate, and it looks like he went on to live an uneventful life until he passed away in March of 1981. We know that investigators did look into the angle that Dorothy's abductor might have been someone who once appeared in Jules' courtroom, but Jules himself even admitted that he could not think of anyone who might have hated him enough to harm his wife. Like I mentioned earlier, it seems like the only reason that Morris Anmuth was ever associated with this case was because of that one Reddit post. Ever since then, it seems like many sources have reported Anmuth's role as a potential suspect as fact, even though I see no indication that he was ever investigated by police. I suppose you can't completely rule out the possibility, but the motive for Anmuth's involvement is incredibly weak. However, the issue is that there don't appear to be any other strong leads about who else could have been responsible for Dorothy's disappearance. Well, before I talk about that, I should address the sighting of Dorothy in Camden, New Jersey, from patrolman Edward Shapiro, who thought he saw her at the same location on two consecutive nights and the days following her disappearance. Of course, in most missing persons cases, there's going to be a bunch of eyewitness sightings that are mistaken, but what made this one stand out is that the woman said, quote, "I've only got one arm," and Dorothy had spent the past few years struggling with a dislocated shoulder caused by her previous attack. However, I am once again inclined to believe that Shapiro saw a completely different woman who just happened to resemble Dorothy. Even if you are skeptical about Marcy's account of the abduction, there is nothing to indicate that Dorothy disappeared on her own accord. It sounds like she left behind her purse and all of her personal possessions, and according to Marcy, Dorothy was wearing nothing more than pajamas and a pair of slippers when she last saw her. And of course, the biggest evidence that Dorothy did not take off voluntarily was the fact that she left behind all that money in her safety deposit box, as I'm sure she would have retrieved that if she was planning on starting a new life. No, I definitely think that Dorothy was the victim of foul play, but who killed her, and was this connected to her assault from January of 1945? Well, it's easy to assume that both crimes were committed by the same perpetrator, but if they had planned on killing Dorothy the first time around and didn't succeed, why wait nearly 5 years to finish the job? The police seem certain that the attack was an attempted murder, and the only reason the perpetrator did not finish the job was because the phone was knocked off the hook during the struggle and connected to the switchboard operator. For all we know, the attacker may have had designs on sexually assaulting Dorothy, but knew they had to flee the scene quickly before the operator summoned the police to the house. While there were no signs of forced entry, we do have the eyewitness sighting from the neighbor who thought she saw a man walking behind Dorothy when she arrived home. So either Dorothy knew this man and willingly let him inside, or he managed to sneak up and attack her from behind before she got the chance to lock the door. I have my doubts that Dorothy willingly invited another man over, as she had gone on a shopping trip before the attack took place, and witnesses from the grocery store reported that she was joking around and did not report seeing anyone with her. It's possible that the attack was completely random, as the perpetrator may have set his eyes on Dorothy while she was at the store and proceeded to follow her home. But then again, if Dorothy was a complete stranger to him, then he lucked out by targeting a married woman who was returning to an empty house while her husband and children just happened to be away. So it's possible that Dorothy had some sort of obsessive stalker who decided to attack her on this particular night because he had been watching her and knew she would be alone. If Dorothy did have a stalker, then she probably wasn't aware of it, since she never said anything to the police, and gave off the impression that she was taken by complete surprise and never got a look at her assailant. However, if Dorothy had been carrying on a secret affair with another man who assaulted her, you have to wonder if she would have told anyone. Even if her life was at risk, such a revelation could have destroyed Dorothy's marriage and social standing, particularly back during the 1940s. Since nothing was stolen from the residence, you have to think that the perpetrator's entire motive was to attack and possibly murder Dorothy. Even though she did not have any known enemies, the beating was so severe that the assailant seemed to have some sort of deep-seated hatred towards her, but why? The circumstances of the 1945 attack and Dorothy's abduction are quite different since she was not assaulted inside the residence the second time around. But if the same man was responsible, perhaps he wanted to abduct her to ensure he wouldn't be interrupted. By all accounts, Dorothy became a lot more paranoid following the first attack, as she rarely ventured outside after dark, and always took steps to ensure that the house was securely locked, so it might not have been easy for the perpetrator to go after her again. But this begs the question, how did this man even make it inside the Forstein residence to begin with? It's been reported that the front door was locked when Jules arrived that night, implying that the abductor went to the trouble of locking it behind him while carrying Dorothy's body over his shoulder, which seems very unusual. Now, I know that when Marcy was interviewed by a psychiatrist, they concluded that she was likely telling the truth about witnessing her stepmother's abduction, but even so, there are aspects of her story which don't make a lot of sense. I mean, we can obviously give a lot of leeway to inconsistencies that pop up in a story which is shared by a 9-year-old, and since Marcy's account has been shared so many times by various sources over the past 73 years, the actual truth might be a bit muddled. This is a problem I often run into while researching older cold cases from several decades ago, as the details get passed down so many times that the whole thing almost feels like a game of telephone. But most versions of Marcy's story state that she witnessed a man climbing up the stairs and then turned to see her stepmother lying on the floor in her bedroom. This whole scenario doesn't make much sense, because why is Dorothy on the floor before this man arrived upstairs and entered her bedroom? The way Marcy tells it, Dorothy did not move or put up any struggle when the man put her over his shoulder, which implies that she was already unconscious or dead by this point. So does this mean that the man had already incapacitated Dorothy inside her bedroom, and then, for reasons unknown, decided to head downstairs and return by the time Marcy woke up and saw him? Since there were no signs of forced entry, could Dorothy have willingly opened the door and invited this man inside after Marcy and Edward went to bed? Well, given her paranoid behavior the past few years, I doubt that Dorothy would have allowed a man inside her home at night while her husband was out, unless it was someone she knew and trusted. Whatever the case, this guy did not seem flustered at all when Marcy suddenly appeared to witness him performing an abduction. Also, since the Forsteins lived in a suburban neighborhood, it was incredibly brazen for him to carry an unconscious woman wearing pajamas over his shoulder when he walked outside. Yes, it was nighttime, but this would have taken place at around 11 p.m. or so, and there was still a chance he could have been seen. You also have to assume that he brought his own vehicle to the scene, because I seriously doubt that he walked several blocks down the street with Dorothy draped over his shoulder. Look, I'm not saying that Marcy intentionally lied, but could it be possible that she just had a very vivid dream about witnessing her stepmother's abduction and convinced herself it was real? I also don't want to question the credentials of the psychiatrist who interviewed Marcy, but you have to remember this was 1949, and mental health professionals just do not have the same level of knowledge or experience when it came to dealing with traumatized children. Events like the daycare sex abuse hysteria scandal from the 1980s show that children can sometimes share very convincing and believable sounding stories about events that never actually happened. Since children are suggestible, these false stories can often come about after they've been coached, so I now want to harken back to the possibility that Jules was involved in what happened. Remember, Jules first arrived home at around 11:30 p.m. that night, but even though Marcy told him about Dorothy's abduction, he initially didn't believe her. He then spent the next 4 hours calling around and searching for Dorothy, and did not contact the police to report her missing until 3:40 a.m. Now, I don't find it believable that Jules could have arrived home and killed Dorothy himself, as there were no signs of violence or foul play at the residence, and I think the time frame is just too narrow for Jules to clean up the scene and dispose of Dorothy's body so thoroughly that she hasn't been found in over 70 years. So if Jules was responsible for what happened, this was likely a murder-for-hire plot, and if Marcy saw something she wasn't supposed to, Jules could have spent those 4 hours coaching her on a false abduction story to share with police. But once again, I've never seen any indication that Jules was ever considered to be a suspect, or that there were any problems in his marriage, and I have no idea what motive we would have had to get rid of his wife. I don't see this angle talked about much, but I do find it interesting that Dorothy's disappearance just happened to take place only a few weeks before Jules' re-election as magistrate of court number 18, and he wound up winning a second term. I know Jules maintained that he could not think of anyone who might have held such a grudge against him that they would harm Dorothy, but could there have been someone who really did not want Jules to be reelected and felt that the loss of his wife might compel him to drop out of the race? Well, I've never heard anyone becoming worked up enough to commit murder over a magistrate electoral race, but stranger things have happened. And yes, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction, so for all we know, Marcy's version of events may actually be the 100% accurate account of what happened. Under normal circumstances, I wouldn't have much reason to feel skeptical about the whole thing, but the fact that the story completely disappeared from the spotlight after Dorothy was legally declared dead, and her family was apparently taking steps to try and scrub this story from the internet 2 decades ago, makes me wonder if they have always known more than they're letting on. Once again, if Marcy is still alive, it would be very interesting to hear her recount what happened that night and see if she still shares the same story. Hell, it would also be interesting to hear from her younger stepbrother Edward, as he supposedly slept through the whole thing, but I'd be curious to know if he remembers that night differently now that he's an adult. I don't know. I guess the main reason we question the official story so much is that nothing about this case makes any sense. If Marcy is telling the truth, it doesn't shed any light on the identity of the man she saw or his possible motive. While it's entirely possible that the original attack from 1945 was a completely unrelated incident which had nothing to do with Dorothy's disappearance, that only opens up more unanswered questions. After all this time, we may never know the full truth about what happened, but I am glad that this case has become the subject of discussion on the internet again, as more exposure can only be a good thing. So if by chance you have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Dorothy Forstein, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about the 1970 murder of 18-year-old Joanne Weigel and the subsequent disappearance of her 18-year-old high school sweetheart, Mike Klein, who became a wanted fugitive before he could be arrested for the crime and has not been seen for over 50 years. In addition, I dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1988 murder of Philip Fraser. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Jeff S. and Jennifer G. Thank you so much for your support. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for another true crime podcast, 10 Minutes True Crime.
Missing people, murders, serial killers, frauds, heists, and mysterious events. The most infamous true crime stories from around the world, told in 10 minutes. Find 10 Minute True Crime on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player.
I also wanted to mention that later this month, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th until the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, roundtable discussions, and live episodes. In fact, at 9:15 a.m. on the morning of August the 28th, I will be participating in a panel session with another podcast called Shockingly Wicked, in which we discuss Unsolved Mysteries. At the session, I'll even be screening a copy of my little scene video titled The Unsolved Mysteries Fanatic, which was made about 3 years before we launched The Trail Went Cold, and was our early attempt to turn this concept into a YouTube series before we ultimately turned it into a podcast. It features me doing my best Robert Stack impression, and not a lot of people have seen this video, But if you attend my session at the True Crime Podcast Festival, you will get an exclusive screening. So in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, which has a lot of interesting discussions about today's featured case. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.